Hello.
Hello.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Wow, this is great. Thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome. Absolutely.
Yeah, basically, I just wanted to say I'm a big fan of a couple of your books, and I just wanted to ask you a few questions about them and
Sounds like a plan. Well, thank you very much. I'm retired now, so I don't have a captive audience, so it's nice to have someone to share whatever wisdom I have to share. Yes, good to meet you. Yeah, you're in San Francisco?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. Okay,
Yeah.
okay. Yeah, okay.
No. And where are you about?
I'm in Iowa City,
Okay, right.
University of Iowa, just retired.
Oh, wow, you just retired.
Yeah, I've just been less than a year, but about 6 months since I've retired, so just living into it.
That sounds great. Yeah, so how do you want to be introduced? Any
I'm a historian. I've written about working hours, work, and leisure all my life. Since I studied at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, my degree is from UNC. I work with some notable people there, among them George Mowry, who is a very well-known historian of the Progressive Era. And so I sort of started my career with his tutelage. He always would say, pick a big topic, don't select a obscure figure and write about that person, even though historians often do that as a beginning, but choose something large to sink your teeth in. And he gave us as one of the topics in a seminar, the issue of leisure in the 1920s, and I haven't stopped since that. Back in the night early 1970s, that I had that seminar. That's how I started. Historian, instructor at the University of Iowa, retired emeritus. How else? I've been a professor of leisure studies, which is and other places. I've served in various places at the university. But among them, leisure studies. And I'm very proud of that. Profession, perhaps, is leisure studies. My craft is history. So I employ my craft to try to understand the possibility of human freedom from work, and what that would mean, and what people have talked about in terms of machines freeing us from necessity, from having to, from need, free a different type of freedom. That the okay, I'm just wandering on, so you go ahead.
No, this is great. Yeah. Marx, he called it the realm of freedom. Some of the figures that you've brought up have had a pretty big impact on this project. Frank Lloyd Wright, obviously one of them. Robert Hutchins, Walt Whitman, and I'm always like sort of curious because America has really sort of lost this
Yes.
main ideal of freedom from economic necessity. People who listen to this show are artists and musicians, and a lot of them are, in order to get their stuff out there, they have to live in an expensive city. In order to afford to live in an expensive city, you have to work not just in the gig economy, sometimes three, four jobs just to make it. And one of the things that drew me to your writing was this idea of a kind of post-necessity world, or at least a post-necessity America and the spiritual foundations of that. Because in my opinion, it's not just something that is a want. It's an actual spiritual need. You know, as you bring back to Aristotle, eudaimonia, and so to me, it's like, how do we get people engaged in wanting this, in knowing the possibilities that automation could afford us, given all this technology, and how do we harness this for the better? You know, so we can actually own our time.
Good questions, and a lot of good minds have thought about that and have written some really great stuff. I see my task as a historian is to simply represent people like Robert Hutchins, have them speak again to issues like artificial intelligence and the continuing loss of work, the continuing alienation from work of so many people, with the growth of the gig economy, the Gallup poll showing that, what is it, 2/3 or more of the working force are not engaged. And this has been true for decades. I've been following this since the early 2000s. That number, 2/3, has varied a little bit, but not a lot. It's going up now. So that 1/3, only 1/3 of us have good jobs that meet the promises we all hear when we're in as children, you know, work hard, do what you love. Only about 1/3 of us are able to manage that with any kind of success. For the rest of us, it's not to say job satisfaction. Job satisfaction is something very different. I've got this job. I don't like it very much. I'm satisfied, though. It pays the bills. And that's one set of data. This other set of data that Gallup has been doing is engagement, commitment, finding a purpose, and looking forward to going to work. So few of us are privileged with that. And again, the last election, I think, is beginning to show that. Or we've been seeing it perhaps going back to the 90s, and Gingrich came along with the Tea Party. We saw that the division that Andre Gortz and so many other people have written about between those of us with good jobs, with educations, and the majority without. The majority of people don't have advanced degrees. And even now, with my... is one of the reasons I like teaching where I teach, is my students are able to get jobs in the area that they are studying.
Right. That's rare. So
if I had if I were a professor of history all these years, I would have taught a lot of folks that the vast majority, 90% of the people with majors in history aren't going to be able to turn that skill into a job, and they'll be getting other job. So this presents so many challenges, and I'm glad you zero in on some of the individuals like Frank Lloyd. I've got puppy dogs here. Is that bad for your get out of here?
It's okay. My cat's right here too, and he's loud sometimes. So it's all good. But yeah, no, the individuals, I think the way that you chart out the history of the late 19th century, the Gilded Age, all the way through to FDR and, you know, the brain trust movement is kind of, I think very few historians sort of trace this kind of, they don't sort of examine the way labor unions had a kind of bargaining agreement with the state, which is something called ordoliberalism, right? You know, like this idea that the, and you could see this a lot with libertarianism today, is that these corporations, they say that they're for a certain thing, but they're sanctioned by the state. And this is, I think, the biggest issue, at least that I've been thinking about recently, is I think the free market can do great things, but we don't really have a free market like Palantir, Anduril, all of these supposed libertarian technologists and technocrats. They're the only way that they're corporations can be made possible is through a state partnership with the
Right.
CIA, the NSA, and so it sort of presents a unique challenge, I think, to us as individuals to look at historical individuals who were set on this idea of free time and Prometheanism and ownership over the means of production. And, Marx, a lot of it has to be updated. It doesn't necessarily follow the data economy. And I think that as a historian, is there a challenge to have to kind of amend or extend the theories of people in the past to sort of address the issues of the present?
That's something that people that has yet to be done. Maybe you can do it. talk about what happened. I told my grandson that I was going to write something perhaps about how Trump's election is a manifestation of Karl Marx's theories about class conflict,
Right.
except a different what a different. A different class war is going on. It's not between the owners and labor. It's between the privileged elite and blue collar people who feel alienated, estranged, not by the plutocrats, but by this class of people that the plutocrats have been able to demonize and hold up as the enemy, a common enemy. The enemy of my enemy is my friend, sort of. And so you have this strange alliance, still a class alliance of the disenfranchised, the alienated worker, and the plutocrat, which is strange, but still, if you think of it, it's a Marxist dynamic that throws up this class conflict. I think that to extend the analysis and that Marx's idea about a counter-revolution fits for, and Lenin, I suppose, fits very well into this because you're going to have the coalition put together a fray real quick between the plutocrat and the disenfranchised worker.
Right.
That's not going to last long, not at all. And so it's interesting times. I'm not going to write that article. My grandson said, prepare yourselves for some hate mail and death
Yeah.
threats if you put that out.
It's
So I'm not.
so, yeah. No, it's hard to convince people of some of these things.
It's clear.
Yeah.
Marx, his idea of class is still convincing in a lot of ways. Well,
No, that's really sort of interesting. Sorry.
I do think as I say, my old professor, George Mallory, look him up. No one knows him, but he is worth knowing. He sort of set the tone for the interpretation of the progressive movement out of populism. Theodore Roosevelt is his masterpiece, the era of Theodore Roosevelt. But again, he's telling us to choose a big topic and work. What happened to the work ethic at the turn of the century? And one of my heroes that got me on this path is a guy named Daniel Rogers. The work ethic in the industrial era. So I can't remember the title of his book, but he writes about the crisis of work at the turn of the 20th century. The old supports of the work ethic, autonomy, social mobility, community, status, respect, creativity, or several more. The heart of the work ethic it supports were destroyed by the coming of automation with the assembly line, with the coming of mid-level management and Frederick Taylor. Frederick Taylor saw this. He saw the rise of boring jobs and the de-skilling, the word historians have been using for a long time was de-skilling. He saw this, Frederick Taylor, scientific manager, the father of French. He saw that and said several times in his writings that craftsmanship is will needs to be recovered in free time and hobbies. Craftsmanship is no longer going to be part of industrial work because machine is here and there's no going by. And so he sees in shorter hours the redemption of the work ethic, the supports of the work ethic, as these characteristics, these positive characteristics, flow from work into free time, and people voluntarily, on their own, begin to actually live into these skills, do them for themselves, acquire them outside of work for their own sake. A lot of people, and that was one of the what Daniel Rogers says, the crisis of work at the turn of the 20th century, most people, he says, Daniel Rogers says, most people turn to free time to restore what work had been losing to the machine. But there was another very important group who wanted to reform work. Save, and the title of the book that I hope I'll be able to finish before I die is Saving Work, A Failing Faith. We have systematically tried, we began the process the first decade of the 20th century trying to save work. The psychologists tried to, give tests to test to find jobs that were appropriate, aptitude tests, and try to adjust work so that it retains those characteristics, those positive traits that were at the heart of the work ethic in the 19th century. The 19th century, of course, being the time that the work ethic begins to spread more than just the bourgeoisie. It's spreading more and more into the working classes. Anyway, in the there's this attempt to recover, to save work. Work is again challenged with the 1920s, with the coming of overproduction, and then the Great Depression with the coming of unemployment. The machine continues to threaten to take away jobs. The response is from labor, let's shorten the hours, 5-day week. Organized labor, the progressive shortening of the hours of labor is what the AFL pushed for all through the 1920s. It's not just 40 hours,
And both
but
Democrats and Republicans were pushing for this too.
absolutely,
Yeah,
Hoover.
Hoover. Yeah, yeah.
When the Depression, I live 10 miles from Herbert Hoover's birthplace. We go over there and walk a lot, and I've been using his papers for years and years, so I know a lot about Herbert Hoover. And part of his response to the Great Depression, unemployment, it was consumerism in the 1920s, overproduction. What are we going to do? And business turned against the threat of leisure, trying again to save work against this threat of progressive shortening of the hours of labor. Consumerism is born. We'll give people new things to buy they've never seen before, in a perpetual process that will expand the economy, that will expand human need infinitely. The title of my first book is Work Without End. A new idea, and people who are in like Frank Lloyd Wright, Hutchins saw it as something brand new, as an idea never tried before, an extraordinary idea of playing God to recreate the human animal by recreating the needs perpetually, recreate, create, recreate. That's Engels. Engels writes a treatise about what I've just said, how human beings are self-creating animals and will perpetually recreate themselves through time, creating new work perpetually. But for the people in the United States who are not Marxists, like Frank Lloyd Wright, he was conservative. He was, if anything, a Jeffersonian Democrat. Shorter hours is the way to go. So you have consumerism is born. Then the unemployment of the Great Depression creates this third wave of crisis. The first wave, de-skilling, the second wave, overproduction, consumerism is how it's met. The third wave is unemployment. Beginning, of course, you know the story of how Hoover responds with Share to Work. It's a voluntary program, business volunteerism, but he organizes business. He brings a guy named Teagle into as an advisor, and he and a guy named Doak, his Secretary of Labor, William Doak, they both organize this Share the Work plan voluntarily. And one of the premier responses was people like W.K. Kellogg at Battle Creek, who went out 6 hours. He's responding as this business volunteerism and and the optimism. There's a good deal of optimism. For me, it's incredible that they looking through all of the indexes that I've used through the years, the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature and so forth, the high point of publications, articles about books about leisure, is in the first the end of the 1920s and the first part of the 1930s. There was a whole lot of people writing about the coming age, inevitability of free time. It's going to come. Henry Ford, he says this in one of his articles. Free time will come. The unemployment, the only choice we have is unemployment or leisure.
And
So,
Keynes predicted by now we'd have a 10-hour work week.
Several people did. Keynes is the most famous, but George Bernard Shaw, Julian Huxley, the economist, the biologist. A lot of lesser-known people were confident. No one. I've done this a long time, Barrett. No one predicted what that is going to stop. No one. Looking back at 100 years process where working hours were cut virtually in half, John Maynard Keynes said, "Of course, it's going to happen." It's interesting. Technology is not going to stop. The Depression and Roosevelt, I think, are key. And Roosevelt turns from Hoover's policy of business volunteerism, substitutes instead. First thing he does is he supports labor's bill, 30-hour bill for work sharing. And so the first year or so of his administration through the 30s, well, through April and May of 1933, Roosevelt was on board with work sharing. Then he turns his back. He holds labor at bay through the rest of 1933 into 34, and elections of 34, the Offutt elections, labor raises holy hell. Roosevelt hadn't done anything except delay Black Perkins, the 30-hour bill in the United States Congress that almost passed within a hair's breadth. The first issue of U.S. News and World Report magazine, you remember that, had on its cover the 30-hour week is within days of passage.
I've seen that.
The first issue of U.S. News and the World Report was wrong.
It's
Sorry. Anyway. What Roosevelt does, he searches around, and he's gotten people in his brain trust, Rexford Tugwell and Leon Kesselring, who are, I think, anticipate Keynes. Keynes, of course, as you know, goes against one of the dogma of economists, classical economists until that time, Say's Law, that production creates its own demand. And there cannot be a general glut in the economy, Say's Law. Keynes says, and begins the Keynesian revolution, it's called, an overproduction can indeed happen. And the state has to intervene. Why does overproduction happen? Why does a market glut happen? People beyond a certain point will not buy the things that are being produced because they don't want them. And indeed, well, this would the backward bending supply curve of labor. I'm not sure you're familiar with that. That as people begin the or diminishing marginal utility, as people begin to buy more and more of the things that they need less and less, as they become richer and richer, then declining the things that are they're buying have less utility to them relative to the first purchases that they were making. Relative to all, but relative to not only the first purchase, but relative to the time that they are selling their leisure to buy these new goods and services. So there comes a point where there's a balance, where the next purchase that I'll make has less utility for me than the disutility or the utility of more leisure time. So I will choose free time. I give as an example, working at the post office in Chapel Hill. I did that for 12 years, going to school there. Actually, it's 10 years, I believe. Anyway, I was at a time when I was working less than full time. I was working about 35 hours, 34 hours a week, and my colleagues at the post office, I was a temp, were giving me hell because why in the world don't you work? I can, you know, stretch out your work. You know, don't. I would go and get my mail delivery, special delivery, get the job done, and go home. I had two little boys, and I wanted to go home and play with them. And I said, "Look, Earl Bush was fussing at me. He said, why don't you take go work, get more money?" I said, "I got a choice here. I can work more, and get a, I said I could get a television set, a fellow television set. I'd like to have one of those. My children would love to have one of them. Or I could use that same time for my children and for I was learning to play the piano. Then I could. I got a choice here. I'm not a communist. I've got a choice between a television and time with my kids. I choose that. It's a free market choice." Available to all of us, and so many people around even without John Kenneth Galbraith writes about the decline of working hours in terms of declining utility vis-a-vis the utility of free time, the usefulness, the value of free time, and that gradually people, as they were getting more goods and services, will turn more and more to buying or choosing their leisure. The income effect would be
Right.
greater. If you use the language.
So what consumers need to also kind of realize is that free time is a type of commodity value, and you know you're sort of like you have to kind of buy your free time or earn your free time. I think about something in even dating back to Holderlin's Hyperion, you know, this idea of like in Holderlin he's writing to his love interest, and he talks about sort of like the beauty of the world, and he's like wants to be sort of enraptured in the beauty of the world, and he doesn't care about the problems or the strife that exists, you know, in the world. His Diotima says, "You have to be worthy of your heaven," and I think that's sort of kind of historically true across the board, and consumption and consumerism is a really interesting thing because an argument that I've heard is that we don't have owned commodities anymore. We have rented commodities because of things like planned obsolescence, lack of right to repair. And I think, you know, when you talk about these Kiserling, for example, you know, his whole thing was just let's ramp up economic demand by increasing government spending.
Exactly.
And that, I think, has led to a lot of problems. And I know the FDR administration is wildly historically popular, but you, I think, present a really fascinating case that this kind of interventionist, ordo-liberal sort of social democracy model that they'd been using was kind of, I don't want to say it's a mistake because of the Great Depression, you know, when speaking to my grandfather, you know, he was a big FDR fan, even though he called himself an FDR Republican because he believed in government spending because poverty it alleviated him out of when he was growing up. So, but you know, these things, they have a trickle down effect, and it's sort of interesting to see, not an alternative history of that, but I think a more accurate one.
I do too. I think that's a story that's been forgotten. I didn't write it so much as to critique Roosevelt. It's just to explain why the hell where we are. Why is it that the government, and it's a Republican, it's bipartisan. It's not. In the middle of COVID, what did Trump do? He essentially, well, one of the images of the cartoon images from the Great Depression is of a great big transport plane and Roosevelt in the belly of it shoveling out money as it flies over the United States. That's what Trump did. He sent out stimulus checks. Exactly. So it's not Roosevelt, only Democrats or liberal. It's as much a Republican. During Republican administrations, the debt usually gets higher than it is with and it will happen again. God knows what will happen if Musk and his cohorts do in fact cut federal spending by any considerable amount. Unemployment will skyrocket. Where the jobs are, or where are the jobs?
But they don't seem to care about that because they're not interested in job creation. You know, it's like, this is the thing that kind of scares me the most. And as critical as I am of the Democrats and of Kamala Harris and, you know, this kind of stuffy liberal elitism that they've kind of, you know, turned their back on in recent moments, I am increasingly worried about the potential of this new class of plutocrats to not reinvest in the common good.
I can't agree with you more.
They're so alienated from labor practices and also cultural practices, they're not going to understand that work isn't something that just binds people to a job, you know. And even if you do release labor, if you do decrease labor hours, there's a lot of, you know, the International Brotherhood of Paper Makers, the director, he said that, you know, jobs, they have to be interesting. You know, they can't just be socially and culturally oppressive, existing in these, like, you know, technocratic, you know, cultureless enclaves. You know, the work has to be meaningful if you're even going to create jobs.
Well, you know, good luck with that one. I've had a lot of Joe Jobs and shit on them. They work that sort of work, and increasingly more jobs are those that you watch the clock. And my image is working in the post office. My life was dripping out of my fingers as I was sorting mail, junk mail, at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's terrible. So those jobs need to be sourced out. And with AI is absolutely incredible.
I agree.
It's going to do to white collars what the assembly line did to the blue collar. Have you tried it at all, Barrett? Amazing.
So I'm a musician and I can't play the drums. I'm a guitar player. And so one of the things that I do is I use AI to actually make drum patterns for me to play over. And I mean, it's like, I don't need a drummer. And as inflation increases and as tangible physical space decreases, you know, having a practice space and finding a drummer, like, these things cost money and they're extractive of time. So I'm like, well, if I could save time and save money and get roughly a similar thing that I need to get done, this technology is great. Is, you know, it's greatly important, you know, especially to somebody like me who doesn't, you know, AI could potentially really help things, but it also replaces stuff too. You know,
that's the danger. It's not danger, but the threat that's going to come true. I mean, it'll write how I'm glad I retired when I did, because, you know, AI will write a convincing essay that I would have trouble. I've done this several times, to write an essay about, and reading through it, I'm not sure I'd be able to tell the difference between that and an actual, except the AI has a lot fewer mistakes. What my students should do is, if I were a student, put on several mistakes. And anyway, the idea that Tugwell's idea, we have to save work by restoring the creativity, the challenge, the status, the skills that work once had. We got to restore that. How are we going to do that? As Tugwell did it for, began that process of of establishing this elite at universities with college degrees. I actually do have professions expand. The definition of professions expands enormously. And so these folks with college degrees have those good jobs, while the rest of the two-thirds, according to Gallup poll, languish. And more people report, more and more people, even those with college degrees. You know the book Graebner's Bullshit Jobs. That's one of my favorite. That I think is what's going to happen. Increasingly, that one-third with or that are engaged by their occupation will get smaller and smaller, as more and more people are alienated at their jobs and don't find creativity and challenge that are promised there. Then I don't see anyone creating jobs, Joe jobs that that have what I see is what Ondra Gorz described, is a rise of a 19th century servant class. And nannies, temp workers, the gig economy, where you find you musicians. My daughter and daughter of son-in-law are musicians, and they are in the gig economy. I mean, they are servants. They are at the beck and call of the privileged elite who hire them for weddings and so forth. I think that's where we're going, the increasing alienation. It's a different kind of alienation that Marx described.
Yeah, that different kind of alienation, I think, it's a really sort of interesting time, and I think about this because this kind of alienation is literally, you're facing a physical divide between human creativity, which has a history of, it's experience driven. It's driven by, suffering, pleasure, life, culture. And then you have the thing that's replacing it, which is machines. And so one of the things that I think could potentially happen is we see a new arts and crafts movement boom out of this kind of maybe something that William Morris or Wright had, envisioned. But the problem is that people, there has to be a kind of, at least a kind of correlation between the machines doing the jobs that we don't need anymore and providing the abundance in order to do these things, in order to have a creative or a cultural craft or folk art renaissance. And actually, sort of one of the things I'm most interested in is how do we have a expansive and holistic American culture again,
There are a number of options out there that you're familiar with, I'm sure. A guaranteed annual income is one of the things. That doesn't appeal to me as much as what I try to describe in my latest book, The Age of Experiences. What is it? Harnessing Happiness to Build a New Economy. I think that is a more lively option, the one that I think is more liable to happen. Annual income is a far-fetched in given our politics, as of now at least. But the fact that there are groups of people, I think, in the gig economy who are making those choices and that of more time to do their own thing. Living in this sort of marginal world where they're more of life and less of the work that provides the wherewithal for life. I think you're seeing that. It's hard to get a handle on it and know what's happening with in terms of numbers, quantify it, because you don't find those numbers with the Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't follow that sort of thing. So it's only speculation that, but I do think that what I'm suggesting is that entrepreneurs like yourself can begin to sell products in the gig economy or otherwise, sell products, experience products, music, playing the guitar, selling those things to consumers who buying those experience skills, those experience products, will need two things. They'll need money, and so they're working to pay you, but they also will require more time. And so they'll automatically, if my dynamic that I described is right, well, they will over time begin to draw down gradually, finding time in their own lives for playing the guitar that they've learned in the experience economy. Gradually, you'll be teaching these people a skill that they need to create an experience that they want to have, they want to consume. They want to consume an experience playing the guitar. They're turning to you to teach them an ex a skill. That's the transformation economy. They are being transformed. They are gaining the means of production. They own the means of production. That's Karl Marx. Owning the mills, means of production, they don't need you anymore, but or the people who are selling it. There this gradual process of owning the means of production, producing their having the skills, which is essential. You can't just turn people loose, I think, and let them, go out and have a good time. You need some kind of educational process. Frank
Right.
Robert Hutchins tried to devote the University of Chicago to essentially a place to teach people what to do in their free time.
That's what he envisioned for the liberal arts, but that just became
Exactly.
another, bureaucracy of
Well,
superfluous language production and, sort of this kind of like bubble of the information worker was largely created
right.
through
That was in the
these arts
process.
institutions.
That's good. I haven't thought about that, but what he was up against was this new elite, by saying, we've got to turn, to give birth to this age of leisure that's bound to come, and we need to use the liberal arts, teaching people not to work but how to live freely. Those arts that are necessary for life. And Hutchins goes by. He's very influenced by the Greeks and the Greek ideal of leisure, and he uses images again and again, talking about the Greek leisure. The ideal was not democratic. It depended on slaves and women being slaves. It's not working the democracy, but what we have, he called again and again, machine slaves. The machine will take the place of the slave in the Greek era, so that we can be inheritors of that Greek ideal of liberal arts. Of finding community, the polis, the place where we gather, the skills that we need to gather, we learn them through the liberal arts. We practice them in our culture, in various places. And he, of course, the Encyclopedia Britannica was part of his deal. The great books of the Western world, part of his deal. But anyway, that's my solution. My hope, my best hope, is that. That people in, so like yourself, are able to sell experiences. That's where the economy seems to be going. People are buying more and more experiences, but sell those experiences that do deliver, that deliver community, that deliver challenge, that provide for a sharing Best of all community, let's stay with that, the Gemeinschaft, the small community where people, what examples? My examples I use in my book are my wife is part of a knitting club that's held at a local yarn shop. The proprietor there is selling her products, but she's making it possible for people to come there, forming a little group, a little community within that commercial establishment. And she, the owner of the yarn shop, is part of the group, of course. And there's this little community, these micro communities established within the business world, within the economy, that are is able to, you see my puppet dog, that are able to number one, provide the experience that people like, and number two, sell the transformations that people need so that they have the skills and they can do it themselves. More and more you are looking for them. My other example is my wife and I love to ballroom dance. We took lessons and we got these skills. We own these skills, but we still have to pay part of an economy, rent a hall over at Eagles Club, the American Legion people, and rent the band and so forth. We're still in the economy, but we're gradually, we're moving out of the economy on our own hook, finding enlivening that place. The freedom, the economy then is sort of like a midwife giving birth through experiences and through transformation, giving birth to this richness, these activities that are in fact worth doing for themselves, that require skills, that require effort, that do give meaning and purpose in a person's life. That to me, I don't. I had hoped for a long time following Robert Hutchins that the university might be a place like for this. I've taught a course in leisure studies called Leisure in the Liberal Arts for 30, 40 years, in which I try to say, think of your education not so much, not only in terms of what job I'm going to do, because most jobs aren't going to use whatever skills you're picking up at university, whatever interests you're picking up. But think of your free time as a place that can be improved. It can be a richness in your life when work begins to fail, as it inevitably will for us all with the coming retirement and so forth. More and more, I think we're going to have to. Unemployment or retirement will come. The only choice is unemployment or leisure. So again, it's the challenge. That leisure is the challenge,
Right.
and I won't. I would like to think that haven't gotten much of a response from the age of experience. It's somewhat,
I loved
but
it. I 100% agree with all of that. And I, you know,
thank you so much. I
it,
appreciate that.
but it's also like I practice that. And you know,
Dude.
when you look at the experience economy, it's the only sector of industry that's grown. Everything else has decreased.
Yes.
And
And
so if we actually look at some kind of real historical trend here, we can see that people are relying less and less on, you know, traditional notions of consumerism. And people are engaged in an active or a kind of prosumer relationship with the economy
exactly.
as a merging of producers and consumers. One of the thing that is tricky about that, though, and you actually outline this in your book, is there can be a you sort of run the risk of exploiting yourself through this notion of being a producer because you're essentially producing for a consumer as well. But you bring up some really great examples of how if you own the skills, if you own, you harness it, but at the end of the day, it's also what you do with it. So it's like if you take that ballroom dancing experience, you can liberate yourself from the marketplace entirely to just be able to dance and do things that you want to do. And to me, that's kind of the most interesting aspect about what I do is I try to means test this stuff and say, hey, can I actually live this way? I talk about this stuff. This stuff is interesting to me, but can you actually go out and do it? And my findings prove that I've been able to do it now for a few years.
Oh,
And
right.
so
For you.
hopefully other people can do that too. And I, you know, and to me, it's like, well, these theories are useless if regular people can't go do it too. And it's not to say that it doesn't take work, but anything meaningful is going to take some, you're going to have to develop the skills in order to do that anyway. So I think you're largely almost 100% correct here. I still think
I always say it's not me. Listen to the people I
right.
quote.
Yeah, but the
I
way you
quote.
synthesize it is really remarkable, I
Well,
think.
that's what I guess the historian's job is to bring together, synthesize, put together things in a puzzle that makes sense. And I don't think it's I think it's not my invention, but it's a real story, something that really happened. I'm that much of an optimistic a follower of Ranke, the historicist, that it's not just a happen so, but that there's a coherence, a natural coherence to this story, that it's not a figment of my imagination at all, but it did actually happen. One of the things that I hope I'm able to write about with a history of work is to show again the spiritual impoverishment that we experience now, the lack of I see your cat, the lack of contact. Is that a Maine Coon?
Oh no, it's he's a tabby.
Okay, the lack of appreciation. Experience of the great mystery that is at the heart of all of our being, that which is beyond our humanity, that transcendent reality we don't make ourselves. We are thrown into this world, we're thrown into a death that we don't understand and we can't control. The idea that I can create my own world, my own meaning. I think it's a dead end, at least. But anyway, one of the things that I'd like to continue to write about is what else can I say? But religious origins of some of these ideas about leisure. Jonathan Edwards, you perhaps will remember this from Free Time,
Right.
The Age of Experience. And Jonathan Edwards, and the people around him. The Christians around him sort of gave rise to the American idea of progress, that we can, in fact, improve our lives, and not only improve our lives by making machines that ease our work, but also make machines that will liberate us for better things. And for, of course, Jonathan Edwards, it's for. The spiritual side of our being that needs to be cultivated and improved. The post-millennial vision is what I'd like to talk to write about, and in some ways sort of take whatever part I can in some of the discussions now about religion, specifically Christianity, and premillennialism is dominant now among the evangelicals. That Christ will come all of a sudden and surprise the hell out of everybody. Body parts will litter the streets. And the post-millennialism, where we human beings are able to prepare to progress, taking care of business, absolutely, taking care of what we need, taking care of our problems, and then going on to improve our humanity, our ability to live together. To share our lives, to appreciate each other, to find community. And dare I say it, for Jonathan Edwards, the word is love. That is the great underlying message of Christianity, is the possibility of love, of caring for, self-sacrifice, of giving of oneself, and the putting of other people first. That idea coming from the Christian world, which of course, as Reinhold Niebuhr, the other Niebuhr, what's his name? Richard Niebuhr writes about this, the Kingdom of God in America. He says that that idea of millennialism predated and set the tone for the American dream, which is advancing humanity, progress, American dream progress, not just material progress, but progress in our humanity. And that the origins of that vision go back to the Christian heritage that we had from colonial days. And I follow that. You can't really ignore Christianity and write American history. It ain't no way possible. That connection, not Christianity, also, I mean, Judaism recognizes the Sabbath as well.
It was the Sabbateans who actually were some of the initial labor and free time advocates. And this is kind of the thing, you hear about like the Puritan work ethic, the Protestant work ethic. Well, Jonathan Edwards was a Puritan, and in many ways that I don't think you can just sort of, and this is another historical maxim or just people take as a given, as a set of priors that the Protestants were sort of the founders of this kind of, work as a means in and of itself.
I think it begins there. I really do. But again, it's embedded in Christianity. The Protestant work is always Protestant. And embedded in Christianity, it has built into it a teleological and eschatological vision. And that is when man works no more. Work is a means to an end. It's only in the 19th century, and then more so in the 20th century, that the religious props, supports, the religious insights about love, our spiritual nature, how those are removed from the Protestant work ethic, and the work ethic becomes thoroughly secularized in the tw by the 20th century. The God talk is virtually gone. Well, you do hear it occasionally, but it's only from the far right. For the most part, it is a secular work ethic. It is a spirit of capitalism, Protestant ethic, spirit of capital. That's why the book that I'm trying to write is Saving Work: A Failing Faith. That this new work ethic is a religion, crypto religion, not recognizing itself as a religion, but yet it has a belief system that is essentially Protestant without the God talk. Human beings are substituted for God in this new work religion. So that's part of my argument that we've lost that spiritual foundation of the work ethic and what now is thoroughly secularized. And we've lost also this eschatological vision that work has some sort of telos, some sort of outcome. And some great theologians write about this. And again, I'm trying to represent them: Karl Barth, Jacques Ellul. Both of them write about work being a crypto religion, a modern religion, the modern rival to traditional faiths. And as such, my argument is that it's profoundly unsatisfying. It's not going to work. The new religion of work is not going to work in the same way that traditional religion, Judaism, Islam, I have always worked as an agent that holds people together. I mean, look at what's happening now in politics. Work is not something that binds people together. It's dividing. It doesn't give a sense of purpose of meaning other than more work, work for more work. What did Bart use a phrase that I can never remember? A certain ambiguity. That this idea that I work, why am I working? Well, I'm working for more work. It to us, we don't think about that, but once you sort of put it in that fashion, the reward for work is more work. It becomes crazy. We had a class of students. I had 12 students. Graduate students from Saudi Arabia that came over to Iowa and studied with us for a couple of years. We hung out with them, taught classes for them, and they one of the things that they I heard several times that they were surprised that the successful among us, deans and so forth, those are the people that are given more work, have more work to do. It's, so that's crazy. In our country, in traditional societies, the people that have made it are successful. Those are the people that are able to take it easy and let other people do their work for them. But we sort of have got it the other way, that somehow or another we bought into the squirrel cage. There's no telos.
It's a grind culture, hustle culture. You see a lot of, videos on social media and YouTube. If you grind for this, you can get XYZ thing. You'll see some guy with like a bunch of muscles and, with a Lamborghini, and he'll tell you that if you just keep working, you rise and grind, you can get this. And I think people buy into that as a form of false salvation. The thing that I want to work for is my ability to just go, grill some hot dogs, outside on a nice autumn day. That speaks more to me, but.
You use yourself as an example. It's excellent. I mean, compared to this guy, this grind guy, I live a simple life. Look around. I don't need much. I need a lot to help my children out, whatever fortune I managed to acquire over these last 50 years at the university, I'm giving away to my children. But simplicity, a simple life. The richness is in the experiences of my life. The appreciation of being able to, during happy hour, my two shots of bourbon whiskey, sitting with my wife and my puppy dogs, looking at the fall for an hour or an hour and a half. That to me is what it's what's what it's about. It's who needs a grind? The reward is the people around me, the times or that I have with, or your music, your ability to play. We sing in the choir, and for me, that's as good as it gets. I don't need I drive an old car. Who needs bigger house? Who needs? I need music. I literally, if I don't sing, and I was sick for a while, and we didn't go to choir, and I languished. I was more of a wretched individual than I usually am. A miserable old guy, a miserable old fart. But and because of music, and the first music we were singing, I told Francine, my wife, that it was like a tonic, like a refreshment, that it refreshed my soul. Same thing with walking. We walk as another of our recreations that we, if we don't walk, I miss it. The time we spend with our dogs, the time for itself in the natural world, looking at the trees and feeling the wind, feeling my own body as I'm walking. The taste for that, I think we can educate by example, or more deliberately, For me, I would hope that by holding up people Frank Lloyd Wright, the joy, look around me, you see, I did this room. It was a garage, and I started to fix a leak back over there in the garage, and I didn't stop until I completely refurbished. That skill of building, it's wonderful. I learned a learning curve when you're building things. Frank Lloyd Wright, we can do it. Ordinary people, we should be teaching people
Right.
these simple skills of say carpentry for those of us who love that sort of thing. And teaching and giving us that freedom to actually, Frank Lloyd Wright thought that we all have this instinct that is satisfied only by this building instinct, like birds building a nest, only satisfied, only the greatest pleasure is this building our own place. There's something to that. Is it there's an activity, you're producing something of worth, but yet the act of producing is as valuable, is as much of a commodity as a finished product. I call those sorts of activities intrinsically motivated productive consumption, giving a nod to my economist friend. But to realize that and find in, I mean, you don't have to be a woodworker or builder, a musician, the arts. My son Christopher is an artist, and he spends a good deal of his life painting. I think maybe I hope that's where we're ha headed. But we need examples that are to be unafraid, confident that the people that are advising us to waste our lives, that we're getting and spending, we waste our powers. I think that's Wordsworth. Our powers to be human. We've sold them for work without end.
I love what Walt Whitman said. He said, something to the effect that if you share your freedom, freedom is something that you can grow. It's something you can extend to other people by setting an example of freedom within yourself. And that's something that I think a lot about in terms of, expressing these tools that we can potentially foster and have and show others, like, hey, we can have these things too. I think when people live a little bit more modestly and they express, hey, I'm happy, that's a way of growing freedom also. That's a way of letting people know you don't have to be in, London or Paris or New York City in order to have a happy, creative, fulfilling life, and I think that that's important too,
Yeah, the title of some, well, I guess one of his books, Specimen Days. He thought of himself as a specimen, an example of how to live freely. A loaf and invite my ease, leaves of grass. You know that opening of the leaves of grass is a loaf and invite my e ease, observing a sphere of summer grass. he was famous for his loafing around. He admits it. He doesn't see anything wrong with that.
with the experience economy. You also talk about like the gig economy and how the gig economy is, it's still tethered to a kind of, even though it's a decentralized kind of workforce, it's still tethered to, I don't know, modern conceptions of work as well. And unfortunately, I think most people exist not necessarily. So would you say that there's a transition happening between the gig and the experience economy, or are they like sort of blurred together a little bit?
I think it's blurred. It's the answer. A lot of it is blurred. We don't know exactly what's happening. Something is happening. I think we know that. Something is happening to work as we knew it in the 20th century. It's unraveling, I should say. The gig economy is coming apart. How is it that, you know, issues like retirement accounts and that sort of thing are going to work going forward? All of that's up in the air. So I don't have a crystal ball, but I do think we are seeing the death of a modern faith. I believe that's happening. The God that fails work. We're not finding a meaning, most of us, two-thirds of us, engagement, purpose, direction, status, meaning. And there's a gradual turning from work to other sources of meaning. And it's fascinating to watch that process. As a historian, all I can say is work as we knew it in the 20th century is not eternal. It's not a universal. It was unusual. Weber, Max Weber, when Protestant ethic and the spirit of capital recognized that long before I came along, that the Western view, the Protestant ethic, was unique in the annals of human history. That view of work as worthwhile in and for itself, containing the spiritual charge coming from Calvinism, that's new. Coming into the 20th century, the spiritual charge remains. The spiritual charge that Calvin and Luther, to a certain degree, provided to the Protestant worth ethic, and also to all the theologians and the preachers and so forth that followed along, that spark is brand new. People who write histories of work still think work is a universal, and they write as if it were a universal. It's not. I did a chapter in a book by Durante called Debating a Postmodern Post-Work Future. Is that right? Debating a Post-Work Future. I did a chapter there, beginning my history of work. And I'm along those lines. What I'm coming at is work is this modern thing. It has changed before, changed radically before, within the last 300 years. And the prospects now, all of the indications that we've been talking about, are that it's in the process of changing again. What's going to result? it's hard to say. I would predict that work would have less of a centralized place, but I may be wrong. I think there's always a possibility of what happened during Nazi Germany, where Nazi Germany, faced with reparations, loss of nationalism, pride, make America great again. Hitler says, make Germany great again, losing reparations from World War I. But more important, the unemployment. What happens, Germany throws up Hitler as a person who promises the redemption of work. He comes along and says, I'll put you back to work. And he does in all sorts of horrible ways. The death camps being his primary achievement, written above the death camps, if you remember, death camps are the slogan Arbeit macht frei, freedom, work is freedom. And what that entails, Franklin Wright feared this. He feared Roosevelt was busy enlisting drafting what word am I looking for? People without jobs, putting them to work, whether they liked it or not, in jobs, whether they liked it or not. Hitler did it. The countries that he overran, of course, he brought people in as prisoners to work, to the work camps. The people that were dispossessed, gay people, gypsies, those who are Jews who weren't working. If you remember Schindler's List, the guy standing there, the German officer, as the trains were unloading the prisoners, Germans, the Jews, and so forth, dividing the people between those people that can work and those people who can't work. The people that can't work were killed. The people that can work were spared, at least as long as they could work. So that's, I think, the right wing, the possibility that we'll have a Trump-like figure, if not Trump himself, who will say, "I'll save work," and he will then do these drastic sorts of internment camps that well, I think we'll begin to see them with rounding up of immigrants that we'll be seeing.
And this is the issue with Trump that I am no fan of the Democrats. Like I am no fan of modern failures of identity politics, and also their sanctioning of the war in Gaza. I think that that just created a absolute losing platform. On one hand, you're supposedly for equity and freedom, and then you do all these hypocritical things, and there's an incongruency there, I think, with the Democrats. But at the same time, it's like, with Trump, it's difficult because on one hand, why can't we dream bigger than doing things through resentment or at the expense of other people? Machines are supposed to be our way out of that. But I think the issue is that our technologists, people like Elon Musk, they're also embedded in the culture. They also share these same kind of views of resentment or expense of other people. And it's not to say we can't crack jokes, and I think in a lot of ways the PC stuff went way too far. As we t you talk about with Christianity, you still have to be loving towards other people. Love is, you have this post-Christian right from Nietzsche. It's just about pure domination. But as a species, if you look at even Charles Darwin said, it's not the strongest species who lives the longest, it's the ones that cooperate the best.
I share some of your views. I certainly fear Donald Trump because he's essentially a madman, in my estimation. But I do share Frank Lloyd Wright's Jeffersonian democracy.
Right, I do too.
Government that governs best governs least. And the way in which government has expanded, for the most part, is in the attempt to say work, to provide full-time, full employment. That's why we are trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. If we're not in debt, the time would have fallen out of the economy. The economy has never, on its own, proven capable of transcending these cycles, the cycles that you mentioned. What's his name? That those long embedded cycles that your guy.
Oh, Conjertive.
Yes. With those cycles that are inevitable in free economies, unemployment is a periodic. The economy is not able to sustain full-time and full employment, so government has stepped in to do that, and the result has been this intervention into the economy. It's not regulations that define liberalism. It's certainly part of it. What defines liberalism is the government intervention into the economy to assure full-time, full employment. For me, that is the primary liberal agenda, shared by Republicans, even though Republicans come at it a different way. Republicans criticize it. They don't have another solution
Right.
other than deficit spending when they get into office. But anyway, that is the primary intervention. And that's the reason that we have a larger government. What, one out of every six jobs in the United States
Is a
are
federal.
government jobs?
Yeah.
What's going to happen? if you do make inroads, and we talked about this before, the Republicans have no idea of the economic chaos that making real significant changes and the reductions in government, what that will mean. For me, that any of these overnight solutions are not going to work. Will require horrible disruptions, even a guaranteed annual income. I'm not sure how that would work. That to me is one of the possible government interventions, but I prefer, and I think the only realistic way in which this is going to stop and the government can be drawn down is by people in the experienced economy voluntarily doing what they did for over 100 years before the 1920s, voluntarily drawing down their work time, finding other things in their lives to do that they think they are better, they're more important, more enjoyable, more meaningful, and so forth and so forth, and so on. I think the universities have a job to do, which we don't do. I know of no other. Well, and I'm not going to say that, but the free market, I think, it has that possibility of entrepreneurs who design experiences that are attractive, that do deliver happiness more so than a big automobile, a trip down the Grand Canyon. I have a friend, a geologist from Arizona State, who retired and he now leads tour groups down into the Grand Canyon. That to me is part of the tourist economy. And the experience economy,
Right.
and he's selling this product, but he has something that is truly worthwhile, and worth not only the cost of admission, but also an experience. Taking time, it takes a couple of days or 3 days to go down and camp by the river and come back up. I'd love to do that. I'm too old, probably, but that to me is one of a good example of the experience economy of selling a product that truly delivers happiness, utility, much greater than buying, say, a new automobile or what else? Going out to eat. Well, even eating is an experience, isn't it? But any of the other types of consumer commodities that we
You brought up Cracker Barrel as an example, as a restaurant chain that was trying to put an emphasis on ambiance and experience and actually your last book. I 100% agree with you. I think we're going to see a huge shift in the way we view production. And also, you bring up a really good point with the federal government. I mean, if you look at Marx's definition of the division of labor, if you base that off of productive habits, given that we've become more and more like prosumers, you know, the blurring of the producer and the consumer has kind of, you know, it's kind of taken shape. You know, we're even as we participate, you know, on a YouTube comment section, we're producing something as we're consuming it. That's kind of the issue with social media and the internet today is it's become something where are we producing? Are we consuming? But you bring up a good point about the federal government because that is the federal government doesn't create any value. The people create the value, the government manages it. So
Right.
if you want to talk about stuff like excess labor, you know, or, you know, shaving off the top end, who's doing that? It's the federal government.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the reasons why regulation of hours finds so little traction in Congress, 1976 being an example, when who was it? Clean Jean McCarthy. He came to Iowa, Gene McCarthy, once. We had a conference, and I got to take him to the airport, McCarthy. But he tried to amend fair labor standards. No traction there because legislators, politicians, there's no future there. You can't tax free time. You can only tax those things that, you know, people buy and sell. And free time is not one of those things that are part of the marketplace, at least directly. You can't tax it. You can't get make a profit from it. So there's a hard to find a political constituency nowadays for regulation of working hours.
Right.
I'm about out of voice here. We've been talking an hour and a half about my limit.
That's a good place to end it.
Well, if you want to do this again, I'd be more than happy to. Enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed talking with you. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of your work, and
Thank you so much.
you would really be surprised at how many listeners have listened to the shows about your free time book. People got a lot out of it, so they're going to really look forward to hearing this. And, these are younger people, people in their 20s, artists, musicians. And, I think we can talk about, art historical stuff and a lot of the baggage that comes with that. But at the end of the day, if you're a creative person, if you want to find meaning in your life, you have to find it through the economy. We are all engaged with the economy, and it's about taking ourselves out of the economy and finding the tools to do that, I think will create a better culture for people in the end.
Well, I think the motive there for people like you and maybe the people that listen to your program have is maybe the same thing, same motive, the same prideful opinion of themselves that Frank Lloyd Wright and Walt Whitman had. Walt Whitman thought of himself as a unique genius. He had no made no bones about it, as did Walt Whitman, as did Frank Lloyd Wright. He thought of himself as a genius. But not in the traditional form. The traditional, what you call the feudal past, and when the geniuses of the feudal age, Shakespeare and so forth, would point to their own works as works of outstanding genius. Frank Lloyd Wright said the same thing. He talked about the feudal past. I'm different, he says. My genius is a democratic genius. My genius is to spawn, is to encourage, is to initiate the creativity, the genius of people who listen to what I say, who read my poems, who look at my architecture, to be inspired, not just to look at the buildings, but to see in the buildings the possibility of creativity, of their own personal liberation, of their own personal access to the things of the mind, to building a house, to writing poetry. Walt Whitman wanted, he wrote these poems with the clear understanding that the people who read them should join him as fellow poets, prosumer, and along with him do poetry. He thought all of us have in us, I'm not sure I do, this spark of creativity that is essentially poetic. And that all, at least people that you know, it's a democratic gift, the gift of words that inspire, the erotic words. He uses the word erotic. He thought of eroticizing the human experience, not just in intercourse in its traditional fashion, but intercourse in all sorts of ways, eroticizing the body, eroticizing his work, his words. So that they bring us together and embrace. Beautiful sentiment. Frank Lloyd Wright as well. His genius is not just his buildings, even though he was an egomaniac. But his genius, his true genius, is a recognition of the democracy that we live in and its capacity to elevate individuals, all of us, into that state of grace, into that state of creativity. A freedom that people, the geniuses among us, maybe the people there who are the vendors in the experience economy, can share that vision of being the midwives, helping give birth to a democracy of a democratic culture, a democracy of creative people, of free people outside of the marketplace, not exploited, alienated by their work. But realizing in their efforts, in their productive activity, their selves in the face of the people, in the presence of people around them in community, and then in contact with that great mystery, with that is at the heart of all of being. I said.
That's great. That's a great place to end it. Well,
Okay.
thank you so much for doing this. This has
Oh, you're
been
welcome, Barrett. It's Barrett,
amazing.
right? Barrett?
Yeah, Barrett.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, you're certainly welcome. As I say, keep in touch
Yeah, of
anytime you
course.
want.
Yeah.
As I say, retired, and I'm trying to write some things, but we'll see.
That's amazing. Well, I really look forward to it. And
Do have a look at that, the book with Durante's book, Debating a Post-Work Future, I believe it is, that chapter that I did. I'm not sure you've seen it, but it's my beginning. It's what, the last thing that I think I'll probably be able to write is a history of work from the word go. And I make a start with that book, with that
Wow.
chapter in that book. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Have
You're
a
welcome.
great day.
You too. Take
Okay.
care.
All
Thanks for
right.
reaching out.